My name is Vern Reike. I teach law at the University of Washington in Seattle, School of Law. And I live in Seattle, and I think that's enough introduction. I've had an opportunity to talk with some of you two occasions before about what I think is my favorite subject of all, and that is the law of contracts. Contracts, as the name implies, is the drawing together. And I like that image because it seems to me that what we are about in our lives is pulling people together. I will, if I get the opportunity, anytime, tell you that I picture salvation, best of all, as a calling back into fellowship that person who has strayed, and to me, sin is, as Isaiah insists that it is in the first chapter of his book, the alienation of man from God, or man from man, or man from nature. It is this separation that somehow or other has to be overcome so that we can be again in communion with each other. I see a lot of that in the law of contracts, of helping people to organize themselves so that they are able to work together in a closer and a more productive relationship. However, I try not to confuse, oh, there's that cold lady up in the balcony. I have all your warm clothes down here. I try not to confuse that law of contracts with the gospel. Yet I find that they are in a particularly fruitful kind of tension with each other, and that leads me to ponder over and over and over, as John Schramm accurately said this morning, this particular tension that exists between the law and the gospel. How do we relate those two things to each other? There are not very many things that I find more stimulating than a stint at Holden. I am so deeply indebted to a place that allows me to talk with theologians and geologists and economists and other types of people because of the diverse perspectives that they can bring to bear on problems that perplex me. And I am always thankful for these opportunities to share with you and to get your insights about some of these things which seem to me to be very important indeed. The last day and a half has done that all over again. Marge Wold, for those of you who were at the session last night, did a wonderful thing when she had us all pretend that we were rose bushes and closed our eyes. And then she told us, she gave us all instructions, as she put it, in the same tone of voice, simultaneously to everyone, about what we were to do with our roots and our branches and our leaves and so forth. And then she asked us to repeat for her the kinds of feelings that we had as we were going through that growing exercise. And it was amazing to see the diversity in the reactions that people had to identical situation and instructions. And she quite accurately points to the fact that we struggle with the meaning of words and the reactions that we have to them. John Schramm this morning did an absolutely magnificent job. I think I can say that safely since I don't see him here. He did a splendid job of demonstrating for us what difficulty even our Lord had in getting people to understand what was meant by my cross, Christ's cross, our cross, and particularly how that pertains to the life that we lead in our day-to-day relationship to the environment and to the people and to the rest of the world that we must meet on a daily basis. I certainly never intend to suggest that Holden is in any sense irrelevant to one's daily life. It seems to me that these mountaintop experiences, where we get to sit and think a little bit about what we're doing, are very important. At the same time, one must complete that bridge and decide how that applies to what you do down in the flatland, wherever your flatland is, minus Seattle. I am a little bit reminded of an archaeologist who pulled a fragment of clay tablet out of the ruins in Italy once when they were digging a cistern or something. And that one was interesting to me because when they started deciphering the thing, it turned out to be an account of a farmer who had lost a couple goats to somebody else. And he thought that they had been converted, that's a bad word to use here. He thought they had been stolen by the other person and taken away, and he wanted either his goats or his money back. And he couldn't get them, so he employed a lawyer. And the lawyer went at it, as a lawyer sometimes want to do, by describing the glories of the Roman legal system and the glories of Rome in general and all the rest of those things. And finally, I guess the client could take it no more because, according to the account, he, the client, then said to his attorney, "You have spoken learnedly about our wars with the Greeks and with the other people in the Mediterranean basin, but is it not now time to mention my two goats?" I mean by this to suggest that somehow or other we simply must struggle with what we are about when we try to translate that which John gave us so beautifully this morning. That is the concept of the cross and what it means in our daily life and how we address other people. For me, that poses, as I have said already, but I want you to understand it, this tension between law and gospel. In that process, how significant are the words? What do we mean by the word? Why does the other John, that is the one who wrote the gospel, see fit to start that wonderful book with, "In the beginning was the word," and so forth? There is a hymn with which I'm sure you are all familiar. Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph o'er his foes, and so forth. After hearing Schramm this morning, will those words ever mean the same thing to you again? Should they? Well, it's time to mention the goats. The case decided in the Second Circuit Court, federal court, back in New York, written by a very good judge, a man by the name of Friendly, Judge Friendly, that's a name, not a description. Never met him. Case is called In re Fregalamont. Those of you who speak French can improve the pronunciation, Frigalment. It involved a New York firm which sold food of various kinds and a buyer of foodstuffs in Switzerland. The particular transaction was for a rather large number of frozen chickens. And the word used in the writing was chicken. That is, the U.S. seller agreed to sell in installments and deliver to the buyer in Geneva a large number of chickens, frozen, for an agreed price. And the Swiss buyer agreed to pay the stipulated amount of money per chicken or case or whatever the quantity was. The price was fixed. The first shipment was sent, and it arrived, and the Swiss buyer opened it and sent back a telegram saying, "You have not sent me chicken, you have sent me stewing hens. And I will not pay you the price that we have agreed upon, because I am entitled to fryers." And the New York seller wired back, "We have a contract that says that I am to sell you chickens. I sold you something that had feathers and went around going cock-a-doodle-doo. That is a chicken. It's not a duck, it's not a turkey, it's not a goose, much less anything else, and you are obligated to pay." "Not at all," said the Swiss buyer. "I am entitled to what I contracted for. And in German or French or any other of the languages with which I am familiar, chicken sold under these circumstances is something that will, you know, pan fry, and not one of these tough old over age and grade critters that you've sent to me. I will sell them on your account and credit you with any money that I receive, but I will not pay you the contract price." They couldn't agree, and so one of them hired a good lawyer, and the other one hired a good lawyer, and they had at it, and because it was an international case, it wound up in the federal courts, and went through the trial court, and it finally wound up in the Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's where Judge Friendly wrote his opinion. If you were the judge, would you decide that case on behalf of the seller or the buyer? Happens to be about chickens, not about goats, but it'll do for the moment. Are you going to give the New York seller the price that was agreed upon for the chickens that was sent, that were sent, or not? Yes, ma'am.
I would, because not for the ones that were sent, because a chicken is a chicken and a hen is a hen.
And because the contract said chicken, that's the word it used.
Yeah. And I mean, if any time you mention chicken, you imagine it, you don't imagine a hen. Or do you?
You don't, I don't know. I was just searching my mind.
The contract wasn't complete.
They should have specified the size, I guess, or the weight, or whatever.
If the contract was in French and the word for chicken in French connoted a different thing, then I'd have a little more sympathy for the buyer. But if it was written in English and just said chicken, I'd have more sympathy for the seller.
Was it the seller's or the buyer's contract?
Yeah. Was the contract between the buyer and the seller? Or do you? I'm sorry, I didn't. Did you ask the question?
Okay. Who drew it?
Who wrote it?
Yes.
The lawyer for the seller.
Yeah. I'd be in favor of your comment.
Because the seller
failed to. The onus is on the seller to provide the contract, which is clear.
But the buyer has to agree to the same contract. If he agrees to it.
The reason, perhaps the reason for this was that the buyer was in Geneva and the deal was made in New York, that is, the contact was made in New York, and it was drafted in the English language.
Were there not other facts?
Yes. The weight of the chickens was given.
It was between not less than so many pounds and not more than so many pounds, and it would include fryers in that weight.
Each of the chicken wasn't given.
Wasn't specified.
Is there trade usage general, I mean, within the chicken trade, which I'm not familiar with? In my familiarity with cases of this type, a judge will generally consider whether or not chicken has a particular reputation within the trade.
Yes, in fact, there is a U.S. Department of Agriculture specification of what chickens are, and fryers, and stewing hens, and so forth.
That might resolve an age-old question: who came first, the chicken or the egg?
No eggs specified.
The number of chickens specified.
Yep.
But stewing hens are much cheaper than fryers.
Yes, indeed they are.
But they're both chickens.
Yes, indeed they are.
They're
and the New York seller thought that he had a rather good transaction at that price because he intended to sell stewing hens. And the Geneva buyer thought that he had a rather good deal because he thought that was a pretty cheap price for fryers.
What
And you see what's going on here. They simply missed each other in the communication. But you are avoiding me. The chickens are in Geneva. And they are thawing rapidly. somebody's going to have to take them or not take them, and somebody's going to have to pay some money or not get paid, and we can't go back and undo history. My next question will be to you: does the seller, whether he gets paid for the first one or not, just assume for just a moment that he gets paid for the first one? Can he then send the next batch of chickens and demand payment for those? But that's a question I want to ask you pretty soon, when I think that you're not suffering quite as much as I think you are right now. Then I'll ask you that question.
I'm sure it never got to the courts before they thawed.
It sure didn't. Chickens were long since consumed, and the money was being held in escrow. Yeah?
It seemed to me the Department of Agriculture makes some inspections on exportation of food products, and if they specify that as a chicken, I guess they'd have to pass on the chicken.
I think everybody agreed it was a chicken. The question was whether or not the seller was selling chickens or had contemplated selling something else, and whether the buyer was buying chickens or whether the buyer was only buying fryers.
It would seem to me, based on the price, that must have been fairly evident through the seller that fryers were intended and that he was, I think I would have to find for the buyer.
The fact that this case went to trial and then went to appeal is a pretty good clue to you that the price was nicely straddled between a stewing hen and a fryer. It wasn't an outrageous departure. You know, either party could have believed that he just made a good deal.
Vern?
Uh-huh.
It doesn't seem to me that there's ever much gospel in law. I mean, isn't law, and if the contract said we're going to send you chickens, they could be anything? I mean, hindsight might be fine, but I always thought that was the point of writing things down in law. Is there a lot of flexibility in looking at the circumstances? I mean, I have a stereotype of judges and lawyers that if the law says it, you don't care who's getting hurt or what's happening. If it's there on black and white, that's it.
Well, I can almost assure you that there's no rule anyplace that says if two people have entered into a contract, one thinking about stewing hens and one about fryers, and they say chicken, the result will be as follows.
Aren't chickens chickens like other meats and products like that? They're graded. They come in certain classifications.
Yes.
And wouldn't that up? I mean, there's something wrong with a contract if it isn't stipulated. What?
Well, that's a promising avenue. Do you mean that there's no contract at all? No contract at all, because the expression that's frequently used in the law of contracts is the minds didn't meet. That is, these people never were drawn together into an understanding, and therefore neither one had a claim against the other.
Yeah. Unless the price received for the chickens that had already traveled was significantly different from the price that would have been received for them in New York.
Uh-huh.
And that the seller had in some way been injured by having to.
Well, if the seller gets the price that was paid for stewing hens on the market in Geneva,
right,
and has paid the costs of shipment and so forth, the seller is going to be damaged substantially, of course. You would never send a stewing hen to Geneva.
For any other reason?
Yeah. The Genovese, if that's what they are, have stewing hens enough. What they need are good fryers in order to justify the cost of shipping. So, yes, sir.
Was there intent to defraud the buyer?
I'm sorry.
Was there intent?
No intention to deceive or to defraud. These people were as innocent as the proverbial new-driven snow. A little bit greedy, perhaps. On both sides, of course, they were making the best transaction they could, and after all, you must do that because you must always bargain if you're going to sell something, otherwise you're a case for the bankruptcy court very shortly. If I can use my favorite illustration, I tried to persuade you a couple nights ago that there's very little room in law for graciousness. Think of the situation when you come to a traffic signal and you have a green light and the other fellow has a red light, and you decide to be mindful of John Schramm this morning and always be gracious, and so you say to him, go through the red light. It's perfectly all right. You go first, thereby resulting in 26 intersection accidents. Is it true that you cannot be gracious when you're operating under rules that call for certain performances? Predictability, you see. After all, law is largely a matter of being able to predict the consequences of something, precedent. It is a principle in law that you must always stay by precedent and observe former decisions, even though those decisions might not be quite applicable in this case, although at the same time you must, of course, do individual justice to both parties in each instance. That's what's known as structured schizophrenia. Always be consistent while you are individualizing each case. It is why lawyers have slogans like, though we are frequently in error, we are never in doubt. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
If the definition of chicken was sufficient to stand up in the contract, I suppose the judge could find an answer that would damage each party the least. In other words, compromise that.
Interesting thing about people who go to court, they don't want to compromise. If they wanted to compromise, they could have compromised without employing lawyers. They go to court because they want the whole chicken or none.
And judges'
responsibility is to decide that that is a contract or that's not a contract. You win and you lose.
Aren't students heavier than birds?
Almost always.
You got the number of chickens supposed to be regarded. You got a weight there. Wouldn't that determine whether it's...
They didn't say anything about the body count, though. They just said the weight and the price. Well, you're doing very well. Let's take another case. This case happens to be the Pacific Peach Growers Association. It's a state court decision, but the principle is essentially the same. The seller here was an orchardist who grew peaches, peach orchard. Almost always got peaches from it. The buyer was a corporation that bought and sold fruit, distributor of fruit. The contract was made in advance of the time when the peaches were growing. A forward-looking contract, of course, as almost all contracts are. And it was essentially this. The seller will sell from his orchard all of the grade A peaches, or prime grade, whatever the top grade. Who's a peach grower? The top grade of peaches, whatever that is, grade A peaches. Seller will sell all the grade A peaches from his orchard. Crop for this year, I've forgotten the price, let's say $5 a box. And the buyer will buy all of the grade A peaches which are produced. Well, I've misstated that. The seller will sell his peach crop to the buyer. And the buyer will buy the fruit at $5 a box, but is not obligated to buy any peach that is not a grade A. Okay? There was one of those not too infrequent growing seasons in which the crop was not good. There were peaches, but they were not grade A peaches. Now this seller was not the only one who was hit by this shift in the weather. Adverse growing conditions. It was a general situation, and peaches were relatively rare. Good peaches were quite rare. And the price of peaches in the market went up. Not outrageously, but up. So they now are more valuable than they would have been if the crop had been more plentiful. It's the law of supply and demand, obviously. The seller said, I've got terrible news for you, Mr. Buyer. I don't have any grade A peaches. The buyer said, I've got good news for you, Mr. Seller. I will graciously waive the requirement that they be grade A's. and I will take at $5 a box all the peaches that you have. The seller said, don't do me any favors, since I can sell them for more than $5 a box on the market, even though they aren't grade A, because of the shortage. And the buyer said, well, you may not regard it a favor if you don't want to, but I get those peaches, because you've contracted to sell them to me. The seller said, I've not contracted to sell you any grade B, C, D, E, or F peaches. I've contracted to sell you grade A. Oh, not at all, said the buyer. You have contracted to sell me the peaches that grow in your orchard, but I had the right to reject them in the event that they were not grade A, and I've just waived that limitation, and I will take everything that you've got and pay you $5. The seller then told the buyer to go to California or something like that. Well, maybe it was Minnesota. And they wound up before you, as you're the judge, they come before you with the buyer demanding either the peaches or the money that he would have made had he received the peaches and resold them. Is that the same case as the case with the chickens? Are you going to decide it differently?
Yes.
I'm glad you've decided how you're going to decide the first one. Because I hadn't yet really gotten an answer from you. But what's the difference?
Intent.
Of whom about what?
The intent of in the second case, especially where he was going to take advantage of the grower. The buyer was taking advantage of the grower, regardless of the quality of crop.
How is he, the buyer, taking advantage of the grower?
Because the price quoted was $5 for grade A, and he was saying $5 for any grade, whereas on the regular market, the seller could have gotten more than five.
Now let's see, grade A peaches are almost always worth more than grade B. And we have a buyer who is willing to pay the grade A price for grade B peach, and you tell me that he's taking advantage of the seller.
Because there is no grade A available, and the going market price would pay that or higher for less quality.
Okay. You make a persuasive argument. Anybody want to make a pitch for the buyer?
Except that we change the contract.
I'll make a pitch for the buyer, because to me the difference between this and the first case is, as I read it, the contract is much clearer in this case. I think the contract is in favor of the buyer in this case.
All right. Yes, ma'am?
I think there's no longer a contract, because the contract was for grade A peaches. And there are no grade A peaches.
Oh, I love to hear you argue that way.
It was for peaches.
Wasn't it for grade A peaches?
No, that he named it for peaches.
I may have misled you because I stated it wrong in the first instance, but the contract was that the seller would sell the peaches that grew in his orchard for $5 a box, and the buyer would pay $5 a box and need not accept peaches that were not grade A.
Oh, I see.
He's exercising his right to accept less than grade A, so it's valid contract. So I would rule for the buyer.
Despite the fact that my co-counsel and I think you're taking serious advantage of this poor seller.
We both entered in good faith into a contract, assuming the risk of future events.
Right.
But
there have been grade A peaches. According to that contract, he only had to pay $5 a box, was it?
Yes.
Grade A peaches. If there had been a shortage of grade A peaches, but there were some, the price on the going market would have been more than $5.
Presumably, yes.
They would only have to pay $5.
Yes.
Therefore, the same thing goes for grade B. Yeah.
But this one is different because it's more or less, I think, what they would call sometimes an act of God.
We do indeed call that an act of God, and it's a terrible thing to do. God is not responsible for
making
these
things. The seller had no control over what was happening.
I'm sure that a lot of you people here either are farmers or have been farmers or are closely associated with farmers, and it just must not come as a shock to you to know that some years you have a better crop and some years not so good. Both people rely on the exchange of promises as distinguished from a covenant in which one party promises to do something under seal or oath only on conditions and no return promise. Does that tick off any kind of thought process in anybody's head? Can you back up even to Herod and John and Patco? For those of you who were here when we talked about whether or not Herod should have cut off John the Baptist's head just because he swore that he would give Herodias anything that she asked for, and whether or not that's different from PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, who, after all, those people took an oath to the federal government that they would not strike, and they did so, and they feel aggrieved because they've been fired. And I think that those of us who sat around here the other day decided that maybe Herod was wrong and the PATCO case is wrong, too. That's pretty consistent. I mean, if you get two errors in a row, that's good. You get to win one next time. Can any of you sense any difference between the chicken case and the peaches case on the basis of the nature of the understanding between these parties? Yes, Dave?
Well, it seems to me that in the chicken case, you have a question of the ambiguity of the language they've used. In the case of the peaches, there is no ambiguity in the language that is used.
The inference that I draw from what you're saying, Dave, is that an understanding is meeting of the minds is very important in the bilateral promise for promise case, but not so significant in the case of a promise which is conditioned.
I'm not sure about that. I guess in the case where the conditions are there, the conditions are understood or should be understood also. They may not be able to know specifically, of course, how things are going to happen there, but you need to understand what the risks are.
Let's test that proposition for a moment, Dave. Suppose that the seller did not understand a word about that condition and that there isn't a crop interference of any sort, that the prices are very normal, and that the buyer comes to the seller and says, I'll buy all your peaches, grade A and grade B, for $5 a box, waiving the condition of grade A quality. Is the seller in any position to refuse to sell his grade B's?
No.
And if you say no, and I got a mumble around here of no's, is that because waiver of the condition cannot possibly hurt the seller?
Well, it's possible that it could still hurt the seller, that he could find, in an especially bad year, he could find it.
No. Good year. Everything's normal. Price is the way it was contemplated.
You can get a good deal, but I already just sell his peaches.
He would be able to sell his peaches, his grade B, at a lower price. Here comes the buyer who says, I waive the condition of quality, I'll take them all at the higher price. He waives his condition. Condition is only a defense. I don't have to do this if they're not of that quality. If buyer wants to waive that condition and be gracious to the seller and pay him a higher price, can this hurt the seller? If you've been able to come this far with me, number one, I'm amazed. I didn't understand this when I took the course in contracts in law school. It was sometime during the time that I was explaining this to a contracts class a year or two later that I first began to understand what I was talking about. You know, if you listen to yourself, sometimes you say some pretty brilliant things. If you've been able to come far enough with me to understand that a condition is only defensive to the promisor. It never creates any rights in the other party. It creates no obligations, ever. And if you can contrast that with a bilateral contract case in which both people are relying upon promises of the other, and both people are at peril. In the chicken case, no matter which way you go, if you enforce the understanding of one party or the other one, you injure the other party of necessity. In the bilateral contract, a disappointment because both parties are at risk in anticipation and reliance on the opposite promise. To enforce one against the other one is to benefit one and harm the other of necessity. Whereas in a promise which is unilateral, that is, it runs only from a promisor to a promisee and does not create any right or duty relationship running the other direction, the waiver of the condition can only be beneficial to the promisee and not harmful. Now I wonder whether we could, for just a moment, try and run the stream backwards and ask ourselves again, why is it in Scripture, both Old Testament and New, that we find so many references to covenant? Covenant is a word which means a promise which is made under oath or seal on condition. God will reconcile me to himself. That's his promise. It is made enforceable by God's own act. He guarantees performance by his own seal, his own covenant, his own oath. Not because I have promised something in return. There's no bilateral contract involved. It isn't a quid pro quo. It is not that God has purchased from me certain services in return for which he will give me certain blessings, but rather that God has covenanted under his own oath freely to bless me only on the condition that I will accept the gift. The analogy I used the other day, very bad one, but I'll try it once again. The dentist who knows that I've got a bad tooth and can't pay for any help says, I will repair your tooth free if you will sit down in the chair and open your mouth and not bite me. He is not repairing my tooth because I promised not to bite him. He is repairing my tooth as a gift. But I must be willing to accept the gift and open my mouth and not bite him. That's covenant. That's a covenant, you see. And God's grace comes to us as free and as unmerited as anything can be. And we have this repeated theme over and over in Scripture, God's covenant, God's covenant. And to me as a lawyer, it is startling that nowhere in the concordance of the Scriptures do I find the word contract. There simply is no such thing in my relationship with God as a bargain for bilateral, buy and sell both ways sort of transaction. I do not dicker with God. Well, but we do know from our experience that God's covenant, starting out in the first of the Old Testament with Noah, Abraham, later with Moses, somehow or other got perverted. And by the time it got around to the latter part of the Old Testament experience, Joshua, Josiah, Ezra, people who decided, kings, leaders, who decided to try and use the covenant form to coerce obedience and performance from their people. the covenant that was made between Josiah and Ezra with the people, for example, was one which imposed upon them obligations. Obligations to obey the strictures of the book of Deuteronomy, the law. And we know that those experiments where the government, Josiah, Ezra, Joshua, now were demanding under penalty of punishment obedience and performance from the persons with whom the arrangement was made. Indeed, Ezra says, and if you don't do it, I will compel performance on your part. I'm talking about the commandments, which have now become law in the legalism sense, rather than being conditions making it possible for God to bless me in the sense of the original covenants in the early part of Scripture. And that latter use of the mechanism is a perversion of God's plan for a relationship between God and man and nature, because it distorts grace into bargain. And so it didn't work. And when our Lord appears in his ministry, he is very careful to say, I bring to you a new understanding of the covenant. And what the Christ does for his disciples in instituting the drawing together of people into a way of life in which they can trust and relate and live in joy and confidence with each other is the covenant. Again, the covenant of the Eucharist. The covenant of the sacrament, the covenant of making one family out of people with diverse interests. And we have a wonderfully rich example of what John Schramm was talking about this morning. A way of relating to other people. It's a way of life. But I also know that God is the God who created structure. And he told me not only to talk about this exhilaration of what makes me a member of the family with you in this wonderful community, but he also told me to talk about that guy's two goats. And all of a sudden I find myself crashing down into the daily grind of people who will not agree with other people. And people who will not live graciously with each other. And people who insist in involving me, because I am a lawyer, professionally in their arguments. And asking me to help them resolve their problem with a victory. And victory here stops meaning what it meant a few moments ago in our new understanding of up from the grave he arose. And victory now begins to mean what it means to most people in the world, I win and you lose. How important is it that we work with our vocabulary and that we try to understand what the words, or if you will permit me, the word, means. It's time for us to go to chapel. I don't want to leave you totally without something to worry you through the night. Therefore, I would like to make a suggestion, which perhaps we can explore a little further the next time we meet, if indeed we meet again. And that's this. Has God set me out to accomplish a task? And has he given me a pair of tools, one called gospel and one called law, which may both be useful in accomplishing the work which God has sent me to do, although one is a much more crude tool than the other. Might it be that law is a way of relating to other people? Not nearly as efficacious, rewarding, rich as gospel, but perhaps in some instances at least temporarily necessary, so that a modicum of order, a reduction of hostility, can be achieved while we try then to be gracious with each other. It's very gracious to be difficult to somebody who's pounding you on the head with a stick. I have a cartoon which some of you have seen about a man who apparently went out to try and control malaria or something. He's standing in water in a swamp, and his comment is that it's very hard to remember that you went out to drain the swamp when you're up to your rear end in alligators. Is it necessary that we have some mechanism, and has God given that to us in law, in a process, so that we can get a space in which grace can grow? Or do I reject that and say, no, John Schramm is right? Oh, no, I shouldn't accuse John of that. That John Howard Yoder is right? That there is no function for the fairness, justice, those are bad words now, that is equal treatment, the demands that you do what you said you would do, the bilateral contract form, the enforcement of expectations. Is there no space for that? And shall we insist that our calling as Christians is to be gracious at all times? That's my law and gospel problem, and I find great difficulty in trying to work it out. However, I'm perfectly willing to try, once again, to make some more confusing remarks about that subject. And I intend to do so, for those of you who want to think about that, in another contract model next time, and that is when a person has undertaken to do something, like deliver frying hens or peaches, and does not do so, is that person sinning? What do you mean by sin? Do you mean that the person has not done the best that the person can do, whether it exactly meets the promise that that person has made or not? Or do you mean that the person has done something wrong and ought to be punished in some way? And when you've decided the relatively simple question of what do you mean in law, do you mean the same thing in Scripture, in theology? Is God going to punish you because you haven't kept the Ten Commandments? Is that a law which you are obligated to follow? Or is God going to bless you if you will just open your mouth, whether or not you have been able to comply with the conditions, the commandments? Do you think that you can deprive God of the right to waive the conditions and bless you even though the peaches aren't ready? Well, that's the question I'd like to talk about next time. Let's go to chapel. Thank you.